morning, Atlanta. It is 10 a.m. on 9/11/2013. Always a day that will live in infamy for us forever.
Yes.
In the studio with me today, Scott Sadler, president of Boardwalk Capital Management. How are you doing, sir?
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And also Eric Holtzclaw, the author and founder of Laddering Works, a marketing strategy firm, and author of the book.
Laddering, yes.
Founder of the company.
Yes.
Not to be confusing. I'm only on my third cup of coffee. You know, September 11th, you can't go without mentioning it. I wonder if people are going to feel that way like 30 years from now, or if it's still that it's so close for us.
I think they will.
I think so, too.
Yeah. You do.
I almost didn't do this show today because
it was too weird.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it was just, you know, I mean, it's interesting because if the term for what had happened had not been the date, I think it would be a completely different thing. You know, if we just called it like the Twin Tower debacle or something, you know, we wouldn't think that way about the date, but we do. So here we are. And, you know, I guess we'll honor that day in our own way, but, let's move on.
Thank you.
Yeah. Moving on from that. We have a lot to talk about today. You guys have both some interesting, accomplishments under your belt, let's say, and some interesting companies and very different. And I think it'll be a really interesting conversation. So I think I'm going to start with you, Scott.
Okay.
Your eyebrows are raised. So are mine. Well,
yes, I'm just mimicking whatever you do.
So. That's a human nature. And I think that's something that Eric could probably talk about.
I'll evaluate you during the interview and then come back and let you know.
Yeah, so.
So before we get started, I guess I should just, I do want to kind of go back and forth between us and sort of just talk a little bit about what the two of you do, because I think that'll add to the conversation. So basically Boardwalk Capital Management, you're an investment firm.
That's correct.
But you have a specialty. So explain that a little bit.
Okay. Our specialty, parallels what people are doing with their lives nowadays. They're more discriminating about what they buy, where they shop, and what they do with their money.
Right.
And most folks don't know that they can actually be more discriminating about their investment portfolio. So we help people essentially invest with their values and help them define that. That's kind of the story.
All right. So you brushed over that, invest with their values. And we're going to dig into that a little bit. But essentially, as you said, I mean, a lot more people, I think, are interested in doing good in the world. And you and I talked about this over coffee. I never even thought about it as it related to my investment portfolio. And when I say investment portfolio, it's a very, very small portfolio. Yeah. But nonetheless, it's not something I really ever thought about, you know. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Now, Eric, let's jump over to you because I want this to be a group conversation. And so I want people to know who you are before you start criticizing Scott and vice versa. So you've done a lot of different things. Author, you know, you're a radio personality, you write for Inc.com, and you have this company, and you have this term called laddering.
Yes.
So I think we should start with that. Okay. What is laddering?
So I took a term that was founded in the 1980s by marketing when they would receive a mass-produced product, and they had to figure out how to sell that mass-produced product to the world. So everybody was building a stereo system. They all had the same features and functions. How do I make my stereo system work better for you? Okay.
Okay.
The world changed about 5 years ago around the same time of the Great Recession, which is kind of interesting into what Scott's world is. Consumers are very, you know, they can pick what they want to. They purchase these products based on what they care about.
Right.
So instead of laddering a product I can build, I now need to understand who the consumer is first instead of building the product and then deciding how to sell it.
So instead of laddering the product, you're laddering
the
people,
consumer, yes,
essentially.
Yes.
So, and what is, why laddering? What does that mean, like, in terms
laddering of... Laddering means to, it actually means to be almost like a three-year-old. So you ask the question, why?
Like, five times.
Five times, right? So you go, why, until you get to the deep core understanding of why that person does that.
I see.
So here I am drinking my Starbucks coffee. Starbucks says something about me.
Right.
At the end of the day. So it's sort of a nameplate, you know, and there's a break between... Back in 2008, neos versus traditionals, which is something I talk about a lot. There's a video I have on the front page of my website, and it talks about the neo world versus the traditional world and how you deeply need to understand what that person's trying to relate about themselves and what they purchase and how they do that. And the only way to do that is to understand who they are. What marketers do is they still use demographics and segmentation. So they say a female between the ages of 35 and 50 who drives a minivan and has 2.5 kids buys this product. And I say that's not true.
Yeah.
It has something to do with something else that really drives her. And so once you get underneath that, you can build products and services that work and resonate with her core behaviors and her core drivers.
So interesting, because for those of you who listen to the show, and I know there's thousands upon maybe millions listening to this right now, I've been talking for the last several months about the fact that I've been catching up on all the business books, and we talked before we got on the air about Good to Great, and I'm actually right now, I actually read this years ago, and I'm back right now reading The Tipping Point again.
Oh, yeah, Blink, Tipping Point, all that
stuff.
Yeah,
I just read Blink, and I read Outliers again, and all of that. And so, but it's interesting because in The Tipping Point, he talks about why people smoke, teenage smoking, and it's the same kind of thing. It's not what you think.
Right.
It's something core as a teenager that drives people to smoke.
Right, and what's interesting is Edward Bernays is a character I talk about, and he's a real person who created kind of the concept of mass consumption. There was no such thing as a consumer until World War II, and we could actually create things and mass produce them.
Sure.
And so he talks about, and I've got the example in my book, how he started making women smoke. And so it was sort of this whole campaign around it. And now it's changed from, you know, the advertiser, the marketer being in charge and telling us what to do and us deciding what we're going to do.
Yeah.
It's a very different way of approaching the market.
And it's interesting. So I want to jump back to Scott now because I want to talk about social investing. And Eric, you know, please feel free to jump in. You know,
because I have a feeling he's going to jump right in.
Yeah, well, because I think there's some really interesting things because you're essentially looking for those consumers who want to invest, you know, who will be your clients essentially and who want to invest in a particular way.
Yeah.
And they, you know, in the mindset of the public didn't quite kind of exist 10 years ago.
That's right. You know, I think what's interesting here, and I'm going to learn from this conversation as much as I'm going to help people.
Me too.
The idea that we don't tell people what to believe is not all that different from what you're saying, which is there's not a product that we're going to market to you. We're going to market to you a service that is defined by you.
Right.
And so, and what I tell people, and the last time we were on the air, I said, you know, there are people who are animal rights activists who their biggest concern is testing on animals, and they don't want any consumer products or household products or makeup or anything like that in their portfolio or in what they purchase that week. That has that sort of sin.
Right.
And for other people, of course, their, you know, their sins are alcohol, tobacco, what have you. But we don't tell them what to believe.
Right.
And so we can define the product, so to speak, by the customer's values as opposed to saying, hey, we've got this great high values portfolio. Let's hope those are your values today because that's what we happen to have to sell.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because, you know, I, as I said, again, you know, when I invest my 2 cents into anything, I really, you know, my strategy is more the traditional strategy in the sense of you sit down with your broker and you say, you know, I'm talking about my IRA, of course, because that's all I have. I don't have any additional funds to invest. But, you know, you say, okay, I have I want to have this much risk and I have this much money and I have this many years, hopefully, you know, knock on wood. And so this is what I'm trying to do. And then they come up with some stuff. And I never bother to say, okay, is there tobacco in there? Is there animal rights stuff? And I don't need, is there oil? Is there, you know, any, I have no idea what I'm invested in. So,
and most people don't.
Right.
And then there's the belief that if you are investing with your heart at all, you must therefore be getting rid of some money into the
you're basically,
you know,
throwing it away
because it's sort of like charity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the steepest climbs in this business is to show people that this is not a zero-sum game where a company that's actually better in the way you define it is going to do worse financially. It's not. They're two totally different subjects, and you have to divorce people from those two. I can tell you when my wife came up with this idea, this was her idea, right? Right.
I love that you
I've been in the business for, you know, 26 years, and 3 years ago we launched this firm. And she said to me, let's do something we'd be proud of. I don't know, what do you mean by that?
Right.
And she said, social investing. I said, that's voodoo. That doesn't work. What's next subject, please?
Right.
But after some research, you realize that I had the same beliefs that the average person has, which is this can't work almost by definition. And as a result, you know, I just poo-pooed it for a while.
Yeah.
But
a technical term.
Yeah.
Poo-poo.
Well, I'm a technical kind of guy.
I hear that.
You know? So anyway, so you learn, and then you have to help others learn.
Well, and I think it's really interesting because, and it relates, I think, a lot to what Eric does in the sense that, and you and I talked about this, you know, a couple of weeks ago, last time we saw each other, that your customers, you know, I think, again, as the world would look at social investing, you would automatically look at younger people and you would say, these are the people that are interested. They're in their, you know, late 20s, early 30s. And of course, they don't have any money. So they're your customers in theory, but they're not actually your customers, right?
Yeah.
But I think the reality is, and this we'll get into knowing your consumer and into laddering a little bit more, that they probably are not a specific quote-unquote demographic. They are all across the board. Yep. It's a matter of finding them and knowing them and reaching out to them in some way. And so they could be, you know, there could easily be somebody who's 65 and loaded who cares and who's just never thought about sitting down with their broker and saying, okay, I want my portfolio to be as, I want it to work for me as well as it could anywhere else. However, I don't want these things in it, or I do want these things in it.
Exactly.
I just think that's...
Yeah, using the right messaging. And what's interesting, because I've done some research in this space around kind of financial planning and that kind of thing, and the transfer of wealth from the older generations to the younger generations is a very interesting thing to look at, because they do not want to work with their mom and dad's financial institution.
Right.
So they really are very much against kind of the old school way of looking at it. They also feel like it's failed them, right? Mm-hmm. Their parents didn't get the retirement that they expected. They've had to work longer, those kind of things. So there are these drivers, you know, and it doesn't have to be the 20 or 30s. But I would say that maybe as you get into those post-Vietnam War, pre-Vietnam War baby boomers, and there's a big split in those groups, it depends on kind of how you're messaging those people, but they do care more about not the old way of doing it, my way of doing it, right? You know, what does that look like? Yeah. So,
I think there's a really interesting question out there, which is, you know, the younger generations appear to be have more altruistic kind of be a very fiber of their being.
Yeah.
More of them are working for nonprofits, more are finding that they want to give back, they want to do more for the environment or what have you. And I wonder, and I just welcome either of you to comment, how much of that is driven by economic difficulties? I mean, my old boss years ago at Wachovia Asset Management used to use the term psychological and sociological palliatives.
Yeah.
Things that we come up with that make us feel better about decisions that we were kind of forced to make.
I hear you.
We don't buy small cars because they're better quality. We buy them because they use less gas and we're out of money and we need an inexpensive vehicle to operate. We came up with this reason to buy a Japanese car. It was a great car, right?
Right, but the reality
first thing, it was
is,
cheaper to operate.
Right.
Or it was less expensive.
It's funny that you say that because I just bought a new car and I've been... You know, I was sort of saying, you know, there's a point at which I'm getting a little bit older and there's a point at which you don't want to drive an entry level car anymore because you feel like because cars and this is a consumer behavior thing. And I know that I'm such a sucker, but like I don't want to feel like I'm right out of college. Right. On the other hand, I don't want to spend a ton of money on a car and I don't want to drive an old person car either, you know, so there's like a very fine line for me.
Right.
I like to have cute, cool, interesting cars, and I need to find that car that's affordable, interesting, doesn't make me look too old, doesn't make me look too young. You know, it's so funny. It's such a personality thing.
So when you read my book, you're Ambitious Amber.
Ambitious Amber. I was going to say, there were three cars that fit your description. It must have been pretty easy.
Well, it's true. I mean, there really is not a lot that falls into that category because, you know, this time I actually needed a more practical car because I do video production now as part of my freelance world. And so I needed to be able to tow around video equipment. And so I was driving a convertible Volkswagen Beetle, which totally fit my personality. Right. But no, for the practical standpoint, not working for me. So, you know, there were very limited choices. And my boyfriend would suggest, oh, why don't you look at a Honda CRV, this or that. I'm like, no, because I don't want to look like a soccer mom.
So you ended up in a Mini Cooper.
I ended up in a Mini Cooper.
Because you saw the Italian job. And if they could carry the gold, then you
could. Then
I could
easily, yes. Well, I got the big Mini Cooper, the big puffy one. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, there were really limited choices for me.
By the way, if I use poo-poo and you use puffy Mini Cooper, I think we're even.
I think so, too. Yeah, and there's more to come. Don't worry. But yeah, so it is interesting because you're right. I think we do come up with quote-unquote excuses.
Mm-hmm. Spender-saver mentality is actually the biggest excuse-driven kind of group. So if you're a spender, you just make excuses for why you can continue to spend. So I used to buy the triple venti lattes until they went to like $4.50 at Starbucks. And I was like, well, you know, if I only get the drip coffee, I can buy Starbucks twice a day instead, right? It wasn't that I was going to save money. Like there's a huge difference between those kind of concepts and thoughts.
Right.
And spenders are always justifying their spend. You know, if you think about extreme couponing, extreme coupon is organized hoarding. That's all it is. So, you know, when you're doing extreme couponing, you're not saving money. You are hoarding on hopefully an organized level, right?
Right.
So it's just a way for you to support that and to continue to spend.
Yeah, I'm such a spender. Oh, God. but it's interesting about you, and you know, as it relates to your business, Scott, because when you ask the question, you know, it is true that the 20-somethings, the teens, I think, and the early 30s right now, they do seem to be more interested in nonprofits and whatever. And you're right. I mean, maybe to some extent that is I couldn't get a real job, so I'm going to volunteer.
Well, I couldn't get a real job or sort of the rules got broken, right?
Right.
Like, following the rules didn't work out for my parents, right? I watched them work their bones, you know, and they're still working and they don't have the retirement that they expected. So why would I do that? Life is about experiences.
Yes.
You know, I want an experience. And honestly, through my growing up, I did experiences. I played games. Yeah. I went after the princess, you know, those kind of things. I talked to a guy, he was hiring kids out of school for Halliburton and they dig the oil wells, you know, and they pay him $150,000 a year.
Yeah.
$150,000 a year. And he said, you know, I can't keep them longer than 3 years. And they only start paying off after the fifth year. So I've got them in, I'm training them. By the third year, they leave me and they go to India to teach English.
Right.
And it's because they're looking for the experience. So they've done that experience for 3 years. He's paid them a lot of money. Yeah. They probably have very little expense, right?
So now they can afford to
go do something that's really more of an experience. Yeah. And so you have to kind of look at that.
Well, that's a whole another, and we can go off on a whole tangent there because I also
feel
like...
Isn't the show about tangent?
Yes. Yeah. Did I say it was called Good Morning Atlanta? No, it's called Good Tangent Atlanta. Well, but you know, one of the things that I think happened for my generation, which I think we're all relatively close in age, so I think maybe you guys can understand
we're
this.
We're all about 27.
Yeah, something like that.
And all very good looking.
And sticking. Yeah,
the
right
joy
there.
Of radio. But, you know, I think for me, like I was raised in the, you know, in the 80s and the decade of more, you know, climb the corporate ladder and, you know, earn more money, get a bigger title, earn more money, get a bigger title, and you just keep going on that cycle.
Right.
And I got to a certain point probably in the mid 90s where I had been doing that now for whatever, 10 years, 12 years, whatever it was. And I said, I have all this money now. I have the big house and it's an albatross around my neck and I'm not happy. So I need to go find those experiences. I need to pursue a different career. So for me, I'm like on career number 7. Which I'm actually okay with. I know, right? But you know what? I'm okay with it now that I've read Malcolm Gladwell because that means I'm a connector.
Oh, there you go.
Because I know so many people in so many different
you're
industries.
Super connected.
That's right. So I'm okay with it. I'm justified now.
It's good. Books do that for us, right?
I know. Isn't that great?
If you keep reading, there is one that fits.
So let's go back to social investing. What are you finding in terms of who your consumers are?
You know, truthfully, they're all over the map. And we were correct when we were talking about sort of the young people. They haven't accumulated wealth. They're still savers. And, you know, they've got a lot of things to save for, retirement, 529 plans, all these sorts of things that no one gets really rich off of these folks, right? As a matter of fact, you'll spend more time on them than you will get in revenue. But you know that we're a certified B Corporation, which sort of has a mission built into it, into our whole business model. And so we feel some obligation to help those folks regardless of how much money they have, which you probably shouldn't say this stuff on the air because then you're going to get all the calls from the folks.
But if people
need help, we're going to help them.
Yeah.
But demographically speaking, I mean, the typical person who has the most interest in what we do at sort of at the core, at the fundamental level, is in their 30s, maybe late 30s, early 40s. People who have technical and architectural and design careers, they're also, they think with a lead, LEED brain, right? So they're already thinking sustainability, environmental stewardship sort of mentality helps them understand how we manage money. And so the first thought for them is, how can I invest in good corporate citizens? I don't want to work for a bad corporate citizen. I don't want to give my money when I spend it to bad corporate citizens. I'm very discriminating about who I like on Facebook and who I rag on Facebook. That's kind of the mentality nowadays. Everyone's is a pundit. And so they've differentiated and they said, this is not what I want my money in. Find a way that I can live that way. How can I save that way? The same way I spend, you know. And so young people think that way. And I think because they're so connected now to companies at a different level than just being a consumer, companies have done, you know, companies like Coca-Cola, they spend unbelievable, ungodly amounts of money on social media. And I think I heard they had some like 25 people they've trained just for the World Cup, just to do tweets and Facebook posts, okay, and deal with all the incoming posts. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're that connected with a company, you've decided, and as they say, you know, someone who likes a Facebook page is more likely to be a customer of that company. So all those things kind of work together. So if you vote with your dollars, then this is just another angle on that.
Yeah.
And so since that youth social media sort of differentiation seems to work together, that's the natural fit for who we are and what we do. And they're very opinionated about what they like and what they don't like. So that's good because we encourage that.
Is there an educational sort of component to what you do?
Hello.
Well, because I feel like there's a lot of people probably like myself who really might be interested in what you're offering, but never thought about it.
She said might. I mean, I've talked to her many times. She's still playing hard to get.
Well, it's because I have $5 to invest, and I don't want you to waste
your time. She's at the tipping
point.
No, education.
One more
is,
conversation. Yeah. This will be it.
Yeah, this is it. I'm cutting you off after that.
No. I mean, it'll push her over. This will push her over.
Do it?
Yeah, okay.
It'll
do
it. All right. No, education is a huge part of what we do. We do conferences that really try to show investors and business people that sustainability and corporate responsibility are not fringe concepts. They're not do-gooder, greeny, tree-hugger, you know, whatever the negative connotation you want to place on that.
Yeah.
That's not who this is. This is not what companies are not becoming better corporate citizens because it, I don't know, it just looks good. I mean, that's part of it, but there's a financial part of it as well. There's a brand building part of it. So we have to educate people that something that sounds goody-goody isn't stupid. That's really kind of what it comes down to. There's a fundamental financial underpinning to being a good corporate citizen. That if you think about Coke, I'll use them as an example again, and Coca-Cola spends a lot of time on water management around the world. They use a lot of water, right? And they've more than just goes in the bottle. It's actually a water-intensive business to make Cokes. And so if you think about the worst optics you could have for your business, if you're Coca-Cola, is the big Coca-Cola truck pulls out, and there's a little Indian kid with a plastic bucket trying to get some water, and there's no water in the wells anymore because you've made Cokes out of it. Well,
right.
They spend a lot of time on that because that's brand building, right? They have to do that because the downside of getting it wrong is so high.
Yeah.
So this is not about being a greenie. It's about doing things that are really in the best interest of the company and its shareholders and happen to be good for society, the planet, or what have you. So that's the educational conversation that we need to have with people all the time. Almost every week we have this conversation with someone and they go, wow, I never heard of that.
Yeah.
Really? You can invest that way?
You know, I do think it's really interesting, and I think we could really do an entire show probably on social entrepreneurship and you know, socially responsible companies and all of that stuff, because I do struggle, having worked for one of them for a while, who shall not be named, but I do struggle sometimes with the fact that because it's popular right now, mm-hmm. that a lot of companies are jumping on the bandwagon and flying their We Do Good flag when the reality is that they...
Yeah, well, what's nice is that they get called out so much easier now, right?
Well, like, that's true.
You know, the knowledge is there. You can't really fake it, right? They don't control the message. There's this kind of breaking of all of that. A book, because now we've talked about books today, but if you've read the book Fourth Turning, that is a very good book. It was written in the 90s, and it talks about what's happening now. And so it's about natural cycles.
Yeah.
And so we've sort of disrupted the natural cycle in the way that we mass produced and mass consumed. Mm-hmm. And we're moving back to sort of that village, like, you take care of me, I take care of you, I buy from you because I know you kind of thing. And so big brands have to work and act that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's more about, in the village, I would come down to you and buy something. You already knew what I was going to buy, right? You already knew what I cared about. And I cared about the village because I live there, right? So people look at it that way. It's a very interesting – we're in one of the coolest times right now because, you know, everybody blames a lot of what happened on the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. So many other things happened at the same time that sort of make us smarter, make us more connected, make us more individual, and we sort of expect to be served that way.
Yeah,
it's so interesting. I'm going to we're going to switch over a little bit to focus a little bit more on what you're doing, Eric, but I just have to tell this little story because it does sort of relate to that local village mentality. So I run a book club. It's one of the things I do, and it's a public book club. It's on meetup.com. It's called meetup.com/Midtown Review. It's based on my, you know, blog and podcast and all of that. And I have close to 300 members online that are part of it. And so they're getting my ad, if you will, quote unquote, every month saying, here's the book and here's the restaurant we're going to. Right. So I'm advertising a restaurant every month to 300 local people who are of a certain demographic, if you will. Right. They're pretty much women who like to eat out and go out and spend money.
Right.
And I keep looking for a new restaurant because we seem to be unable to find a restaurant that will give us everything we need. They don't. And in other words, we need a space where we can hear each other because we're trying to talk and we want to keep the bill down, but we do drink and we do eat and we will spend some money, but we don't want to spend $500 or $1,000. We don't want to pay for a private room. We're willing to meet on a Monday. So you would think we would be the perfect group for a restaurant. They want to fill seats on a Monday. Why wouldn't they want to cater to us? I cannot tell you how many restaurant chains I have called who don't really get it.
Right.
So the other day I finally said, you know what? Enough of this. I lived in Roswell for many years and I owned a business there. So I know a lot of the business owners. So I called my friend who owns a restaurant in Roswell and I said, this is what I need. And she was like, well, yeah, of course I'll do that for you. So I had to kind of go back to that village mentality because the corporations that I tried to deal with completely didn't get it.
Right.
But they would be essentially getting free advertising. All they have to do is let me use the private room.
Yeah.
I'm still going to pay a bill. You know, it was amazing. And as soon as I called my friend, who's not a good friend, by the way, like this is somebody. You know,
obviously not. You didn't call her first.
Well, only because I didn't want to go to Roswell. I mean, right. Ideally, I didn't want to be in that location. Yeah. I was trying to be more central and kind of keep it in Sandy Springs so people from all over Atlanta could come easily. But I finally just said, you know what? This is crazy.
Right. Yeah.
And here, a local business, you know, I talked directly to the owner. This is the only restaurant she owns. And she was like, yeah, absolutely.
All based on relationship.
Based on relationships. And I think that's the key in so many ways to good consumer interaction.
Oh, absolutely. It's an interesting world because marketing used to be about a transaction and sales used to be about a relationship, right?
Yeah.
So marketing was, I get you to the store and then someone else sells you. So they establish the relationship and sell. Now marketing is relationship and sales is a transaction. And that's a scary world to be in, right? There was a study that came out in February, 57% of business to business buyers have already made the decision. 57% have already made the decision before they pick up the phone. So all the salesperson does is either screw the deal up or push it across the line, right? They're not really helping to make that. And if you think about when you buy your car, right, you go in, I've gone in and bought two now and taken my smartphone and shown them, I want this one. How much, you know, where is it?
Yeah.
Is it on the lot? No, you don't need to know that anything else about me.
Right.
Just show me the car.
Right.
And before it would be about, you know, my kid goes to the same school yours does and I drive the same car
right.
and all that kind of wonderful stuff. And that's not what we want.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is really interesting. So let's get more into this whole concept of why.
Well, what's interesting about it is that it sounds really difficult to marketers, right? Because they think about, because I say everybody wants to be an individual. The funny and crazy thing about it is that people actually are very similar. So they still do pattern, and they pattern together in big clusters, and you can make them feel like they're individual even though they're inside that cluster. But it's not about demographics or segmentation. It's about other kind of core drivers. I call it in my book consumer DNA. And so it's, you know, things like, for example, people who like to have friends who are like them.
Yeah.
So like when you were in school, the person who liked to hang out in the sorority, that kind of stuff, versus people who have friends that are not like them. So they intentionally look for people who are not like them.
Interesting.
That's a huge marker in how you look at somebody and start to talk to them and think about them. So if you start to look at some of those things, and what's problematic for marketers is they're like, I want something that I can like look at you and know, right? Or look at a census data. And it's not a lot of questions. Typically within a context, you have to ask two or three questions or create two or three marketing campaigns that will attract the right type of person to kind of fit to their core DNA. So it's not as hard as it sounds. Like I say this and everybody's like, it's really not. It's just a matter of spending some time talking to your customers. So that's what I advocate in the book. Like actually get outside of your doors and go talk to the people who might be buying the product from you. And you'll start to notice the natural patterns of what they say over and over again. And you only have to do about 18 individual interviews.
Interesting.
It's not a lot.
That's really interesting.
Yes.
Why is 18 the magic number?
It just is. I've done it enough now. The company I was with before, we did 150 projects a year, talked to people one-on-one in their homes. I've been on farms all over the world. I've looked at people, and it's about 18 to 27 within a narrow enough context.
Sure.
That people start saying the same things, and you can notice by like the way that their house is set up or who they are or whatever, who they're going to map to. So it's paying attention. And it's also having a conversation that's broad. So what marketers do is they go in and they say, hey, look at this thing I built. You know, what do you think of it? Immediately you've narrowed that person into a topic about coffee or restaurants or whatever. First talk to them about who they are.
Right.
So spend the first 20 to 30 minutes understanding who they are, which drives marketers crazy because they're like, just get to the point. The point is to understand who the person is and what their unmet need is. I was talking with some people yesterday about the Apple announcements, you know, and Steve Jobs is famously quoted as having never done market research, which I don't necessarily believe because I've read the biography and looked at a lot of other things. What Steve Jobs did that is so unique, there's two things. One, he looked for unmet needs. So he was a computer manufacturer company who created a iTunes store and an app store and then a phone. Like we now just accept they have a phone. Do you know how many years we talked about, will Apple come out with a phone, right? Like, mm-hmm. they've looked for unmet needs. So they didn't build something because it was cool, right? And the Samsung watch, wristwatch thing,
yeah.
they built that because it's cool.
Right.
I don't think they built that because there was an unmet need.
No,
right?
I don't. I that one is going to, I just, like, can't imagine.
Who wants a fourth screen, right? Like, we've now added a fourth. So you have to carry your phone with you to use it.
So I guess we can put Google Glass in the it's cool category?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, yeah, you can put it in the cool category.
The whole
it's
watch
not that
thing,
cool, by the way.
Right.
And also, I'm sorry, but I'm going to, hate to keep bringing it up, but I'm getting a little older and I'm quite sure I will not be able to see that watch screen.
That's one of the things I said. Yeah, the watch screen, the screen is too small, you know, it, and jewelry and things like that. Like, it's cool to carry a Rolex watch and have an iPhone. It is not cool necessarily to have an iPhone on your wrist.
No, right? I mean, I am not going to get with that trend.
Right, very different. So thinking about the differences that Jobs went for unmet needs and built products that fit in unmet needs and was willing to completely break his business model to do so, right? You know, and disrupted so many different industries. And he was willing to throw something away. So you read over and over again in his biography how he would get to a point of almost ship and then just say, it's not good enough.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't ship it. That doesn't happen. You know, most companies, when they get close to ship, they go, patch it, put a Band-Aid on it, ship it out, right?
Let's just see.
Yeah.
Maybe
so,
it'll work.
Right. So it's establishing those unmet needs. And the only way to establish an unmet need with your customer is to understand your customer's world, their environment.
Well, I think that's kind of just a good philosophy to have on life in general.
Yeah.
Listen occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Open your ears.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's part of what you're doing, Scott, because you've said to me before, you don't necessarily invest – you don't have one portfolio that you say everybody should invest in. You want to know what they like and don't like.
And you know what's funny? I was reading something the other day about the power of too much choice, or the problem of too much choice. Mm-hmm. And someone showed a video of a grocery store that had 250 kinds of jam and like 150 kinds of olives. And you would get there and you'd go, I'm not going to buy any jam.
Right.
Because there's too many to choose from. And they did a test where they showed people, okay, you have 17 choices or four. The people who had four choices actually went back and bought some jam.
Yeah.
The people who had to pick among 17 bought no jam.
Right.
Okay, so I'm looking at my business and going, because it's so customized, maybe it should be simplified.
Yeah.
Maybe the appearance of customization, but with something where you can actually grab it, hold it, and say, that's the thing I want in that package, would actually be better.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of reinventing that and deciding, you know, how much customization really is required when there are really four or five types of clients that, you know, and truth of the matter is, yeah, you do follow the patterns and you tailor it similarly to those folks.
You know, one of the things, and you talked about, Eric, marketers not wanting to sort of go outside and go talk to people. And one of the things I always talk about on every radio show I do is I wish that the CEOs would go out and actually use their own products, call their own customer service lines, try to buy a car from their own dealerships, you know, try to order something off the menu. You talk about too many choices. Cheesecake Factory to me, which always had good food, but I would go in there and I would be so befuddled by the menu.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that ultimately, after having been there two or three times, I picked two things that I liked and I always order one of those two things.
Right.
And so having all those choices is not good.
No.
And
it's also expensive.
Yes.
To the company.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, then there's both sides of that. So depending upon your brand, and I talked a little bit about this traditional versus neo, traditionals are cheap, 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 right? So if you're marketing to them and they're not reacting to the marketing, stop, right? Like, stop it, because you can save money, because that's all they want to do is save money. Mm-hmm. When you get into the neo world, which is sort of like this more kind of higher brand, those kind of things, those are the people who are actually going to make the most money for you. So spending money in technology and really reaching them is important. So it's a both choice, right? Mm-hmm. And getting outside the boardroom to build products and services and marketing messages, like, people sit in boardrooms all the time. I work with companies all the time. And they're like, yeah, we thought this would be a good idea. We built this little thing. What do you think of it? And I'm like, I don't know yet. Let me go talk to some people and I'll tell you, right?
You know, I'm so glad that you brought all this up, because one of my pet peeves right now, and we're going to talk more about this off the air because there might be some cursing involved. But one of the things that just drives me insane right now is the number of surveys that you get.
Oh, and a survey. People do not know how to craft a survey.
Thank you.
They do not know what question they're asking.
Thank you.
And it is not a cheaper way of doing qualitative research. Surveys are meant, please listen to me, people, are meant to confirm something, not to learn something. So if you are doing a survey to learn, you are doing it wrong. You must be using a survey after you already know. You're confirming the size. You're confirming. It should almost be a count. So when these people, SurveyMonkey, all these other mm-hmm. products that are like, oh, anybody can write a survey and send it out. Number one, do you want somebody who did the survey for free or $5 really telling you what you should do with your product or service? Like, are they a qualified candidate for you at the end of the day? And questions, like a lot of the stuff I do is a nuance of word, mm-hmm. right? One word to me might mean something different to you. And if I can't ask the follow-up question, I have no idea what that meant.
Well, and some of the other interesting points to me about it, you know, first of all, I get a survey for every single thing I've ever bought, done.
My doctor.
Same here.
Right. And if you don't answer fives, they call you and berate you, right? I used to a car place, and they would be like, how was your service? And their car, my car was not clean. I gave them a four. I thought the world was going to end. I'm like, do you want me to answer honestly, or do you just want me to give you fives?
Yeah, I went to the dentist yesterday, and before I even got home, there was a survey waiting for me in my email. The dentist. I mean, really? Is that necessary? Yeah. I'm going to keep coming back. I need my teeth cleaned. Don't worry about it. You know, it's all good.
Right, and if I have a problem, I'm really going to let you know.
I'll be screaming in the chair.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But it's so, yeah, I think it's so interesting because it's so unfortunate because there's probably some really good surveys out there and they're getting lost in the shuffle of the ones that are so meaningless and annoying and stupid. And here's the other thing. Could you ask me one question? Like one, maybe two, not 17. Yeah. Don't ask me for 15 minutes of my time.
Right.
And here's the problem with all that. The people who actually spend 15 minutes of their time and take the time to answer it are not the people. They are people with too much time on their hands.
Right. And I've watched, you know, there's a lot of these systems that you can go and sign up for and be like a tester and do that. And I've talked to those people and they go through them as quickly as possible. They're just trying to get that incentive at the end of the day.
Sure.
They know what their time is worth. Mm-hmm. So why would you trust that, right? Like,
right.
Why not just go spend, like I said, 18 conversations with your customer in their house or wherever they're going to use your product? Because if it's a work-based product, that makes sense. And just find out. And you'll learn stuff you would never learn. You would never learn in your office. You would never learn taking him to a lab. Simple. It's really simple.
And it's funny because that company that shall not be named that I used to work for, they would do surveys sometimes. And I mean, I'm not quoting by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel like the gist of the survey was, do you like me? Check the box. Yeah. A lot?
Leading.
A lot?
Right. Leading, well, leading, leading.
Right. And there was no, like, no, I hate you answer.
Yeah. Right.
And so then they would come back and they would be all proud of themselves. People like us. You know, they gave us a 4 out of 5. And it's because, like, four meant kind of.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
It's either one, which is off.
Yeah. Right.
Or all versions of pretty good.
Right.
And you mean, well, they're not.
I mean, honestly, I think that for me, the survey needs to be a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or a middle finger. That's it.
That's good. That's a three choice. I like that.
That's
a three
it.
Scale.
There as close as she can come to cursing.
Exactly. I like you, I hate you, or I want to give you the finger. That's it. You know?
That's hilarious. Yeah. We talked about that a bit. And I also talk in my book about focus groups and the overuse of focus groups. Focus groups are also a terrible method that's overused by marketers. It's an attempt to get to the answer faster. They think that by, you know, putting surveys out or by doing a focus group that they're going to learn quicker. And that's not true, right? It's not any harder to do kind of the individual understand who the customer is and then move to something where you know how you're sorting those people. If you do a focus group and you say, oh, I've got all these people in a room because that's my demographic, those people have very different drivers. That's why there's such a mixed message around those types of concepts.
Yeah.
So it's really about getting into your consumer's mindset, understanding who they are. And I talk about marketing because marketing really should be driving product. You shouldn't be building a product and then figuring out how to sell it. Right?
Yeah.
You should be talking to your customer and then developing products based on what they tell you. So I start with the marketing slant, but all of this stuff informs the right types of products you would build moving forward.
Interesting. You know, I think we could go so many different ways on this, but I also want to talk a little bit about, you know, you can market and, you know, you're trying to, as you said, build that relationship now as opposed to the salesperson doing it. But what are the things that people can do that just drive their customers away that they're not even aware they're doing?
Well, overselling is actually the biggest thing. So if it's relationship marketing, right, that means that we're friends, you know, and companies, people see brands as friends. I know it's crazy, but they're people that they, you know, bring into their life that they spend time with. I spend more time with my iPhone than I do anything else, right? Any other person. It's very important to me. The apps I put on the phone, those kind of things, right? And so relationship is about being useful and helpful to me, not overselling, right?
Yeah.
So that pushes me away quickly and doing something that's outside of your brand charter. So what I mean by that is if you're not a cool brand, be okay with that, right? Like some of the things we've seen with JCPenney, you know, this whole debacle that's been going on with them. Number one, incredibly internally focused. So it's like, who's right, who's wrong? I don't really care that the new CEO wants to come onto YouTube and apologize for everything the CEO prior did.
Yeah.
Like just show me what you're doing, right? It's not about an apology. It's about your actions moving forward.
Yeah.
So they get internally focused, you know, internally kind of minded, and then they kind of break that trust of who you think they are and what they're going to do for you. So yeah. JCPenney's issues prior with the other CEO where they made these dramatic changes
right.
without really talking to consumers and slowly making the change.
I swear, I'm very frustrated right now because, you know, we have a little bit of time left, but I swear I could have each of you on and talk for 3 hours on social entrepreneurship or on marketing.
No.
He's just
Scott. Scott's already bored. He's like, I want to go home.
Well, I've heard my own story.
But times, the thing is, there's so much more to it than your story, right? And the same thing with this. I mean, there's so many facets to marketing and to, you know, consumer behavior and to understanding consumers and understanding investors. Well, and
no, you're absolutely right. And that's what Eric was saying, that these are really interesting times.
Because
it's like everyone got thrown into the air.
Right.
And we're kind of looking to see where it all falls.
Right. And we keep blaming the Great Recession on it. Yeah. And there, the same time we got Great Recession, right, we got mobile. We got like internet everywhere, right? We got social media.
Right.
We got all of this stuff. Like there was that tipping point, if we want to go back to that, at that same time, which is disrupted distribution models. Like, you know, there's things that we used to buy tangibly that we now buy on our phones for 0 to 99 cents. You know, the whole world just changed. Yep. And so we're trying to fix those problems in old ways. And
we all have kids. And we have these conversations about how things used to be. And they cannot even imagine them.
But oh, right.
You
oh,
did
no.
what?
Can't imagine them and also don't know that how they fit because it's not as that traditional model doesn't exist. Right. Like the rote teaching, because we go into the whole education thing, but you know, like what that looks like and how we really need to prepare kids for being in like, you know, intelligence, like IP based workers versus like being able to put a knob, a screw on a wheel or whatever that is.
Yeah. It's so interesting that, you know, getting back to companies sort of overselling, you know, we always use, Apple's the example for everything, you know, they really are. And it's a classic example because I too have an iPhone. I've completely translated myself from, because I used to be a programmer in the Windows world. So I stuck to it for a long time.
Me too.
And then I eventually, now I have a Mac and I have an iPhone and I have an iPad and I rarely get an email from Apple. Rarely. And I love them for that.
Right.
You know, whereas some of the other brands I interact with, they message me constantly and there is a point at which you unsubscribe.
Yes.
And you're not only, and then the brand didn't, you actually start to hate the brand.
Right.
Because they've just irritated you so much, interfering with your life, messaging you in all these different ways.
Right.
That, you know, I think that's a huge thing for companies.
And it's, you know, it's crazy. I buy from Banana Republic.
But
at least 3 times a week, I get advertisements for dresses.
Yeah,
you know,
like
you
really?
Could at least, Hello? You know, look, I'm buying men's clothes,
right?
You know, so why would you do that, right? And there's this concept of personalization in their world is that they say, Dear Eric.
Yeah. That's
you know, they don't like do anything more with that data. And there are so many systems. One of the companies I consult with allows the consumer to come in and set their preferences. So what information you want to receive. And Amazon does a great job of that, right? That's one of my favorite examples. My daughter was buying all the teen romance, you know, back when the Twilight series was going on.
Right.
And I may or may not have read the teen series, but I started getting a lot of advertising from them for the next one. And so I went in to unsubscribe. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm tired of getting this. And instead of unsubscribing from everything, they allowed me just to turn off teen romances. So that's really smart. Like marketers have to allow you to correct the conversation because it'll go awry sometimes, right? Yeah. You'll make a random purchase that, you know, baby shower, wedding gift, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden things start to come in. You're like, I'm not really interested in that. Like I don't woodwork, right? Don't send me woodworking stuff.
Right.
But my father-in-law does.
Yeah.
Right. So how do I correct the conversation so that you don't send me stuff I don't care about?
Yeah. And see, for me, they're again, like, I don't even want to bother with that. So I just get annoyed. And after a while I get so annoyed that I just unsubscribe.
Oh, wow. I'm learning everything about your DNA.
I mean, really, that's what ultimately happens. And I'm a big Amazon shopper. I buy a lot of stuff on Amazon. And the fact that they will send me an email asking me to rate a toilet plunger like irritates the living daylights out of me.
Hilarious.
You know, because what's the answer? Well, I don't know yet.
Right.
Thankfully.
Right.
And I hope I never have to find out. You know, or whatever.
Well, that's
like,
remarkable. She buys toilet plungers before she needs them.
Oh, you
want to
be prepared.
That's also part of her DNA, right?
That does say something about her DNA, too. There you go.
Were you a Girl Scout?
Why did I invite you to one? I mean, there again, it's a classic thing. Like they need to do some looking at their own database and say, here, if you want to ask me to review a book, great. A movie, fine. But really, like a screw that I bought to replace one that fell off a lamp, like I don't care. I'm not going to.
Yeah, well, this is this argument around big data, you know, marketers, like how much data can I collect? It's really not about collecting as much data, because there's a couple of things that are wrong with that. As a marketer or a company, if I collect way too much about you, I'm actually responsible for the data I collected.
Yeah.
So that puts me potentially in a position of risk.
Yeah.
And also, I don't need all of that. So like, I only need to know a certain thing from you because of the context of the things you purchase from me.
Yeah.
So this big data conversation is kind of weird. Like, they're trying to go back to the Nielsen ratings and, you know, demographics when they did matter. They did matter. You know, we let advertisers tell us what it meant to be a male of a certain age or to whatever. And we don't any longer.
Yeah.
We're like, I make my selections the way I want. So as a company, I really only need you to know these things about me.
Yeah.
And once you know those things, you can service me all day, and I'll never expect you to do something outside your charter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So. I mean, I could continue on and on. And I love that when all my hot buttons come up, I can bitch about surveys and ratings and, you know, social media is another interesting thing. And too much data, you know, talking about big data, it's kind of interesting because, you know, you talked about 18 to 27 people in terms of going out and interviewing people. And again, in the tipping point, he talks about groups of 150.
Right.
And anytime a group exceeds 150, it becomes too big.
Yes.
And it's because you lose the relationships.
Right.
You know, I mean, I know in my high school class, we were more than 150. We were 300. And so there were all these subgroups, right?
Yes.
So it's very interesting. Can you believe I actually remember high school? But, you know, it's...
We're all 27, I thought. So.
Oh, right. My bad. But it's very interesting because I think there's an interesting dynamic potentially with social media, too, where people are out there just trying to grab numbers.
Yeah. And numbers don't matter.
Right. And I think you talked about, Scott, when if somebody likes your Facebook page, then they're more likely to be a customer of your product.
Supposedly.
Right. But there's a whole thing now where, like, they'll do a contest, let's say.
And then I would say that.
Accumulate likes.
Yeah, I don't. You see, like, what's interesting in the social media space is you can't look at numbers. You can't look at how many times somebody was mentioned, how many things, like how many. And that's, marketers are always like that. They're like, oh, they all downloaded my app, or they talked about us. Or when Miley Cyrus is on the VMAs, there were a ton of people talking about that topic, and we're not watching the show.
Right.
So you cannot translate one to the other,
right?
There's a whole social media group that wants to get more people to follow them, to talk about themselves. And so you have to look at, and what's cool about social media, unlike in some mediums, you can go look at their profile, and I can read a social media profile and tell you what the person's DNA is because of what they share both on the profile and the type of information they're putting in their posts. So it's a matter of evaluating who's saying it, why they're saying, why. That's what you need to ask over and over again, and then get away from what.
Right. It's so interesting because, like, I'll go onto a Facebook page and I'll like something because a friend asked me to, because it's their business.
Yes.
But I really don't care about it, and I'll never go back and look at it again.
Is she describing mine?
Did I like
Possible.
Your page?
No,
I don't think
so.
I even liked your
page.
You don't even count that far. So.
And then conversely, like, if I get, you know, something and there's like, you know, you go and like this page and you can win, you know, a new Dyson vacuum cleaner or something, I'll go like the page and there again, I'll never go back.
Yeah.
And because I don't really care.
Yeah.
So then they have my number.
Well, they come back to you.
Well, and
if
they come back to me too much, I'll unlike them.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's a very fine line.
It is.
And so is my like, is that one that added to their account to make me, you know, to give them 20,001 relevant in any way? Probably not.
No.
Which means that what actual percentage of your likers, I'm creating a new term.
I like that.
Are actually relevant. And I think it's probably 1%.
Yeah. And it depends on your brand. So it really depends on your brand. So the more social your consumers are, the more likely those things are important.
Yeah.
So if you're not a very, like a Dyson, not a social brand, right? But if it's something that has more of a social presence, is a socially oriented brand from not social, like you talk about, but social media like, then that could be more important. You have to look at, there's a brand filter. So it's like, who am I? And then what customers do I naturally attract, right?
Yeah.
A primary versus secondary. And then there'll be people on the kind of the fringe.
So interesting.
And you have to be okay with the fact that it's not everybody.
Yeah.
Right? It's all about quality. It's not about quantity.
Right.
You know, looking at who those people are and making sure you're getting the most relationship out of them.
Right. So there again, like if you can go and get 150 people that really like you, legitimately like you, that's probably way more important than getting 10,000 people that really don't care.
Right. That don't pay any attention to you at all.
Just like getting a survey and getting, you know, 100 or, you know, 300 or 500 or 1,000 people to answer a survey is probably far less important than legitimately talking to 18.
Yes.
Love that. All right. Before we wrap up, I know you have an event coming up, right? So let's mention that.
I'm going to be at the Dara Brustein in Atlanta does a wonderful event. It's an under 40 under 40 networking event. She also has an over 40, so there's an under 40 and an over 40. Not that anybody in the room needs one or the other. And so Dara is holding the event tomorrow night. It's at 10th and Piedmont. So, and there's going to be, there's typically 250, 300 people there. And I'm doing a book signing tomorrow night. So the first 50 people who come get a free book. And after that, you have to buy it. So you better get there early.
Wow.
And there's also a Venmo card, a company that I'm working with that's going to give back for people who do have to purchase at $5 of the purchase price.
Nice.
So, yeah.
So it's at 10th and Piedmont, which is the new restaurant there where Outright used to be, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's kind of cool. It's like a book signing where a bookstore used to be. Oh, it's a little bit sad.
Sad for you. And then it's from 6 to 9.
6 to 9 tomorrow, 10th of Piedmont. And if people need more information?
They can go to, it's I think under40atlanta.com. Okay. So it's, or maybe just under 40. I need to look at the thing. If you go to my website, which is www.ladderingworks, L-A-D-D-E-R-I-N-G, works, since some people think it's lattering, and I don't know, but ladderingworks.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, which is at eholtzclaw, E-H-O-L-T-Z-C-L-A-W. I use Twitter all the time and love to talk to people that way, so I can give you any information there.
Excellent. And Scott, anything coming up for you that we need to talk about on the calendar?
Nothing right now, but
you just had a big event, I think.
Well,
right?
And we're just we just did the Green Business Expo, which was kind of nice. It was a little bit small, but we had a great panel discussion of B corporations from Atlanta.
Yeah,
and that was good.
You a shout out on Weekend Review.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. The next thing we're going to do every year, Boardwalk, along with the Green Chamber of the South, does a conference called Sustainability Interactive. And last year we had maybe 120 people there over at Georgia Tech, where we had sustainability directors from companies like Coca-Cola, UPS, Georgia Tech, Agnes Scott College, and et cetera, et cetera. Big companies and pretty good-sized universities. And you got to sit down and talk to these people and understand what sustainability really means. This is part of the educational thing we were talking about, right? We're doing that again probably right at the end of October. Hopefully not Halloween. That would be weird.
That would be weird.
But it'll be a day and a half affair, and we're working right now with Georgia State University's Executive Education Program to try to coordinate it with them. So it's going to be interesting. I would just say if people are interested in that sort of event, greencs.org is the Green Chamber's website, and that's where it'll ultimately end up. It will also be on boardwalkcm.com, which is our website.
Okay, so also if people want to invest and they want to know more about what you do.
Yeah, boardwalkcm.com. We're on Facebook. Twitter is boardwalk_SRI, which stands for Sustainable and Responsible Investing.
Very cool. All right, well, I want to thank you both for being here. It's been a great conversation.
And of course,
I always need to thank our sponsors, World Trade Center Atlanta. So a shout out to them. For more information on what they do, go to WTCAtlanta.com, and also Central Atlanta Progress, another of our sponsors. Mm-hmm. And you can find out more about everything going on downtown by going to their website, which is AtlantaDowntown.com. I'm Dana Barrett. We'll see you on the next Good Morning Atlanta.